Indie Proud, yes, Indie Proud, on Indie Live Radio. Indie Proud, yes, Indie Proud, on Indie Live Radio.
Thank you very much, Joanna. Very, very thought-provoking indeed. Because we weren't intending to hold the meeting in the church itself, the arrangements for our question and answer may be a wee bit more interesting, if we could put it that way, because we've got the one mic here. Now, I'm told that the acoustics are actually very good in this church hall. I'm not going to sing to try them out, but anyway, I'm told that. So I'm going to suggest that if Joanna and Michelle would like to come up here, they could share the mic, and if you have a question, I'll sort of leave it to the ladies to appoint who's allowed to ask the question, and if you can just ask your question to them, if that's okay with yourselves.
One thing I would say is, you don't just need to ask questions about the Scottish Stock Exchange. You can ask me anything.
And me also, within reason.
The question I'd like to ask is in relation to the referendum bill. If you consider in case of law, precedence has an issue, would it be better if Parliament continues to say no to a Section 30, the referendum bill is passed at Holyrood, that it be tested initially on a point which is not the referendum?
Okay, so this gentleman's basically pointing out that at the moment, going through Holyrood is a referendum bill, which is really setting down the rules and regulations for referenda to be held in Scotland on any topic. Can't imagine what they might have had in mind, but you'll be aware that Nicola Sturgeon has been very clear that the SNP party policy is to get a Section 30 order from Westminster. Just to explain what that is. The position is that it is not clear whether or not the Scottish Parliament has the constitutional power under the devolution settlement to hold an independence referendum. Some lawyers say it doesn't, some lawyers say it does. But certainly the safest way to do it is to go through the legitimate route of asking Westminster to grant Scotland the powers under Section 30 of the Scotland Act to hold a wholly binding constitutional referendum in the way that we did in 2014. But of course, in order to get that, you have to have a British government that's prepared to play ball. Now, last time, David Cameron recognised that because Alex Salmond had won an outright majority for a policy of holding a referendum, and he agreed to give the Section 30 order. It's pretty clear that it's going to be hard to persuade a British government to do that again, even if the SNP were to win an outright majority in the future, because it looks like we'll win this time. We didn't think we had a hope in hell of winning last time, and we nearly won last time. We've got a much better chance of winning this time. But Nicola Sturgeon's been very clear that she wants to do it by the book. And one of the reasons she wants to do it by the book, and she's right to want to do it by the book, is so we can get the international recognition that's required. Because if we don't hold a legitimate referendum, in inverted commas, then the European Union, most importantly, but other international institutions might not recognise that might not recognise the vote, and the British government might refuse to negotiate with us, so we could find ourselves in the sort of impasse that Catalonia's in. Although Catalonia's a rather different situation, because the Spanish constitution says that Catalonia can never leave Spain, there can never be a referendum. The British constitution, which of course isn't written down and depends on convention, doesn't say that, and the principle has already been recognised that if a majority of Scots want an independence referendum, there should be one. But to answer your question, what could be done with the current referendum bill? I think you were asking, should we test it on some other, perhaps less controversial issue? I don't think so, because I think that would be an expensive exercise, and I think the public are getting a little bit sick of constant elections and referenda, apart from the political anoraks like myself. So I wouldn't do it that way. All I would say is that there was a very body of respectable legal opinion in 2012. Many distinguished Scottish public lawyers said that because it was so unclear whether or not Holyrood had the right to hold an independence referendum, one way to test that would be to pass legislation to hold an independence referendum let the British government challenge it in the courts, take it to the UK Supreme Court, and if the UK Supreme Court said it was all right, then you had a legitimate referendum without a Section 30 order. If the UK Supreme Court said it wasn't all right, well, you were just back to square one. Now, that is an option for us, but it's not an option that the First Minister is minded to follow. And I have to say that I think she's wise to look for the gold standard, because there's no point in having a Pyrrhic victory in a referendum where there's not a decent turnout, where it's abandoned, or even the idea that you would have a general election as a mandate to negotiate independence. That's not much use if it's just a one-sided mandate and you can't get the other side to the table. The beauty of the Section 30 order and the Edinburgh Agreement back in 2012 was that the British government were committed to respecting the result and negotiating with the Scottish government in the event of a yes vote. And so I think Nicola's right to pursue that as the best way of doing things.
Just to add something to that from a slightly different perspective, a couple of themes. One, I've been around speaking to lots of Yes groups and SNP groups over the last year or so, and I'm sure many of you here will feel a sense of frustration because you're already strongly Yes or strongly committed. But I would re-emphasise what Joanna was saying in her remarks earlier about how important it is that we bring people with us. And to that extent, I welcome the almost healthy tension we've got between some of the aspects of the Yes movement and the SNP. Actually, arguably, one needs the other, because these marches that Joanna talked about, yes, it gives a chance to celebrate common cause where we're all of one mind. And coming from where I was, I'm sure Graham as well, growing up where you were kind of a voice in the wilderness. Yeah, that's great, but the Yes movement needs the SNP. And actually, I would argue that the SNP needs the Yes movement as well, because that's the boots on the ground that we need. So the other point I would make as well is that you can imagine that there's some clear strategy, and there has been a very clear strategy adopted and stance adopted by Nicola Sturgeon, which I also agree with, because as things have played out, you know, they say in politics, never interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. And the mistakes made by the UK government have been absolutely legion. However, the complexity of the situation, how it's changing, is very, very difficult to call. And Joanna alluded to what might happen if we crash out of Europe at the end of October. From my perspective, from a business perspective, it is disastrous. And it's hard for me to emphasise how difficult it will be to our lifestyle. So it's all to play for. I too agree with the approach, because we are positioning for recognition, we're positioning for getting things right. We don't want to be a pariah in the wilderness, but I do appreciate and understand people's frustrations. So when I talk to the Yes movement people and those kind of groups, what I say is, for every hour you spend enjoying yourself on an all under one banner march, promise me and promise yourself that you will spend at least double the amount of hours talking and engaging with your family and your friends and your community around to your point of view. Don't lose sight of, it was always about boots on the ground. This is why, you know, Joanna and I have had the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of giants who years and years ago put all that effort in.
In the event of us being independent and the UK taking us out of Europe, what roughly would it cost Scotland to be a member again of the EU? Have we any idea of what the annual cost of that would be?
Not whatsoever.
Well, great question, but I actually don't know the answer, and I'll be honest about that. The mechanics are such... Any independent study you look at shows us the benefits of Scotland being in the European Union. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about the EU 3 years ago, before the EU referendum. I thought I was a bit of a Europhile. But what I have learnt in the last 3 years is way more about how closely intertwined our economy and our culture and our society is with the European Union, and to what extent Scotland benefits from that. But also we need to remember what Scotland brings to the European Union. You know, the most significant offshore wind and wave power resources in Western Europe. That's what we bring to the European Union. The incredible tourist and food and drink industry in our country. That's what we bring to the European Union. People forget that one of Britain's biggest exports is Scotch whisky. And Scotch whisky benefits from the European Union, not just by going to other EU countries tariff-free, but by the agreements that the EU makes with third-party countries. So, for example, Scotch is going into South Korea tariff-free now as a result of a trade agreement. And that's actually really important because South Korea is a growing economy, and drinking Scotch whisky is a status symbol. As people move up in the world, they want a bottle of Scotch in their drinks cabinet. And so we have so much to offer the EU and the world through the intermediary of the EU that I am confident that the costs of being in, that the benefits of being in the European Union for our economy and for our society and for our young people, for our education, will always justify the expense of being in the European Union. The benefits will outweigh the costs.
From a business perspective, I mean, there's no way, I don't think anyone could stand up here and say, yes, it's going to cost X. That would be absolutely impossible. It's going to cost what it's going to cost. And the basis of what it's going to be cost is on a negotiation. That negotiation will look in the round at the benefits, as Joanne has highlighted, that Scotland will bring in terms of, you know, its premium, and she talked about food and drink, education is one that she didn't mention. And that will be part of a negotiation, and perhaps thinking about how that negotiation is done is best emphasised by Joanna's comments about how we behave and model on the world stage. And we will need top negotiators to look at every single element. Will the EU want them? Of course they will. And it's not just what we bring culturally and economically, it's also geographically our position. I mean, I have no doubt about that. And I, like Joanna, have spoken to people in Europe, us as an MP, and afterwards as well. So there will be a negotiation, there will be costs, and there will be benefits. And as in any business-driven negotiation, there'll be a price put on them. But I firmly believe that the benefits, as indeed is the case just now for Scotland by head of population, that the benefits will clearly outweigh the costs.
If UK Supreme Court decides one way or the other, can...
Could we take it further?
Can we take it further? It would be ironic if Boris took it to the European Court, I think, under Brexit, but could we take it further?
Well, if you're asking me...
The question...
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is along the lines of, if we didn't get a Section 30 order, the gold standard, if we didn't manage to achieve what we achieved in 2012, which was an agreement with the British government, that Westminster would give Holyrood the powers to hold an independence referendum and the result would be respected. Now, as Michelle and I both said, we support that as Nicola's approach because we think it's the right approach. But in a hypothetical situation, this is purely hypothetical, say, for example, the Scottish Parliament passed legislation to hold an independence referendum with legal opinion that there was an argument that was within the competence and then of the Scottish Parliament, and then the British government challenged it. It would go probably straight to the Supreme Court, depending on the rules. It might go via the outer house of the court session, the inner house, but ultimately the UK Supreme Court would decide. In that situation, it wouldn't be a question of European Union law, it would be a question of domestic law, so it couldn't go to the European Court of Justice. There are, of course, other courts, such as the European Court of Human Rights, but I don't think it would be going there either. And I think people... What I always say to people is law cannot solve political problems. Law can create opportunities, like the Article 50 litigation made it clear that if Britain took the political decision to revoke Article 50, it could do so unilaterally. This litigation that I'm currently engaged in will hopefully establish that it was unlawful for Boris Johnson to prorogue Parliament, and Parliament will go back. But that won't solve the Brexit problem. It will just mean that Parliament gets to work on it, not just the British government. So there is no legal shortcut to independence. We have to hold a referendum and show that the majority of Scots want independence. That's what we need to do. And there is no legal shortcut. much as many of us might like to think that. It's a matter of democratic and political legitimacy. The last time Scotland got to vote, the majority of people who voted want to remain part of the UK. And so we have to hold another independence referendum, and we have to find the best way to hold it, which is the way that Nicola wants to hold it, and then the gold standard, and then get a majority so that will be internationally recognised and recognised by the British government, and we can commence negotiations for Scotland to become an independent member of the European Union.
European citizens living in Scotland, will they get a vote or not if there is such a referendum?
If there's an independence referendum and Holyrood controls the franchise, then European Union citizens will get a vote the way they did last time. The Supreme Court, the judges in the Supreme Court don't represent the nations they're there to. They have taken the judicial oath. They are supposed to be impartial. Naturally, the judges coming from the English tradition will be of the English tradition and will look to the English tradition. That's their training, in the same way that the Scots will be of the Scottish tradition. But the decision of the Scottish judges in Edinburgh last week didn't turn on any difference between Scots and English law. It was a modern public law decision. And so it is possible for the United Kingdom Supreme Court to follow the same line of reasoning as the Scottish judges say. I'll honestly tell you, as a lawyer, I've got a lot of time for the UK Supreme Court. Much as I want to see Scotland have its own constitutional court after independence, I've got a lot of respect for the UK Supreme Court. They're very good on rights issues, and I think they are, I believe they are impartial. But what I will say is, if they decide, exercising their judicial oath, that the British Constitution says it's all right for the British Prime Minister to suspend a parliament that's getting in his way because he doesn't have a majority, then frankly, I won't think much of the British Constitution. It'll be the British Constitution that I'll criticise, not the judges. Gentlemen, sure. There, yeah.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you for that magnificent international done here.
Okay, right. Well, I used to be a lawyer for 25 odd years, and now I've turned into one of these nightmare people that I used to dread when I was a lawyer that are always litigating. And so this is the third piece of litigation that I'm involved in just now, also with Joe Maughan and an English guy called, forget his name, Dale Vince. He's a green, he's an entrepreneur in green energy, and he's bankrolled this action for us. What we're doing is, if you remember, it's so hard to remember what's been going on in Parliament because it's all been so crazy. But before Parliament was prorogued, it passed something called the Benn Act. That was Hilary Benn sponsored it, which basically says that if there's no deal by the 19th of October, then Boris Johnson has to go to the European Council and ask for a further extension to the Article 50 negotiation period after the 31st of January. And that is after the 31st of October, sorry, and that is now an act of Parliament. It's a royal assent from Her Majesty the Queen. So it is the law of the land that if Boris Johnson hasn't got a deal by the 19th, he has to ask for an extension of the period after the 31st. But as you all know, he's been going around saying he's just going to ignore that. And I think there might be litigation about that because there's rumours today in the paper that somebody's discovered a loophole in the act. I've not had a chance to apply my mind to that yet. But the other litigation that I'm involved in is a petition to the highest court in Scotland, the inner house of the Court of Session, Scotland's Supreme Court, to get them basically to declare that he must obey the law, and if he doesn't put pen to paper and write that letter, then the court will do it on his behalf. And the reason we've chosen to do that in Scotland and to approach it in the way that we have is last week in London, the organisation Liberty, they tried to bring similar proceedings in the English courts to get the English courts to make a declaration or to pass an injunction, which is like an interdict, preventing him from breaking the law. And the English court said that's premature because you won't know whether or not he's broken the law till after the 19th of October. But there's something in Scotland, there's a power that Scotland's highest courts have, both the civil courts and the criminal courts, called the nobile officium, sometimes referred to as the knob off by those of us in the know. And basically that's a sort of a special power that the court has to right legal wrongs where there's no other remedy. And so we're saying this is so, to use Lord Brodie's word from the other case, so egregious, so outrageous, that a British Prime Minister should refuse to obey a law passed by Parliament, that we want the court to say that in this particularly unusual situation, if he doesn't write the letter asking for the extension, the court can. To be honest with you, I've not researched the law. I mean, I'm not presenting the case. It's been presented by the same legal team that presented the Whiteman case and this case that we've just won in Edinburgh. But they think there are reasonable prospects of success, and that's good enough for me because they've been right so far.
Just to add one thing to that, which again, there's some themes running here that Joanna's touched on. Probably I, like you, I mean, I kind of confess I'm becoming a bit of an egghead. I knew it was called Knob Off before Joanna said that, because at 3 o'clock in the morning when the news announced, I was actually reading the book, the chap who'd written the book about Knob Off, which I think is a special kind of tragic. But actually, what we've all got to do is to keep growing our knowledge. These themes around where the legal route can be used for both a specific and a general purpose is very important, and we want to understand about that. So the case that Joanna's just had has been a very specific purpose, but as she says, if the Supreme Court rules against that, there's a very general consideration where you heard it being openly discussed in the radio programmes this morning that discuss, is it okay if we obey the rule of law? And if you look at the wider backdrop of what Johnson's trying to do, he's taking his rule book from what Trump has undertaken in the States, where quite quickly you tear up conventions and norms of behaviour, whether it's legal or otherwise, and say, what of it? And really equally quickly and alarming when you look at the States is people said, yeah, he's just like that. He just lies all the time. And we're already hearing that narrative from about Boris Johnson. So it's not just the specifics, it's also the philosophical element that we need to keep mindful of. If it becomes the case that the Supreme Court says, yeah, that's okay, you just go ahead and do that, that's an absolute outrage. What kind of state are we continuing to be tied up to? And we can all, even if we're not legal experts, and I'm certainly not, despite reading stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning, but we can, and we're good at this in Scotland. Let's not forget where we've come from in terms of our enlightenment. We understand our language about to what extent is this appropriate for how we choose to live our lives. And those arguments are as equally important to people in the street as well. So we've got to have several strings to our bows as all these different threads go along.
Somebody at the back there, yes, yeah.
Hi. I'm Matt Campbell. I'm the convener of English Scots BS, and I'm also loan bought the other day. My question is about fundamental point of democracy. I'm trying to speak up so on here. David Mandela, a couple of months ago, before he was shuffled out, said that the Scottish Parliament have the right to ask for a referendum, but the Constitution is reserved for Westminster, so Westminster has the right to say no. I don't accept that. Here's my question. If they refuse us a Section 30 argument, Section 30 order to give us the right to a legally binding referendum, what more can the people of Scotland do democratically and morally? Because at that point, we will have voted presumably in the next election for another SNP government, an SNP government before the mandate, and people of Scotland have voted for that, the Scottish Parliament voted for that, and I think if you hold 59 Scottish MPs, a majority are in favour of that. What more can the Scottish people do in a democracy to obtain an independence referendum if we are refused that right? Because the Claim of Rights says we have that, the UN say we have that right. What more can we actually do?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question, because if I answer that question, this is being recorded, the newspaper headlines tomorrow will be that Joanna Cherry says we've got to do this. I'm not going to say beyond that. I agree with Nicola Sturgeon that there must come a point where such refusal becomes untenable from the point of view of a democracy. I've already said that there exists potentially an alternative route by testing whether or not the Scottish Parliament has the power to hold an advisory referendum. That exists as an alternative route, but I can only assume that it hasn't been taken for good reasons, and that the preferred option being a Section 30 order is because we know if we get that and we get an agreement with the British government, they will respect it because they will have to respect it, and most importantly from our point of view, international institutions such as the European Union will respect it, and it won't be any it won't hold us up from rejoining the EU as an independent nation because they don't recognise that our referendum was held constitutionally. But it's a bit, the situation at the moment is very fast moving, and I think there will come a time when we, from time to time, we will require to review our policy options. And I think it's very healthy that we should discuss our policy options within the Yes movement and within the SNP. But you'll forgive me if I'm a little bit cautious in going any further than that, because I seem to have a tendency, if I do speculate about other routes for theoretical or legal interest, of being reported as though I have said that I'm disagreeing with the First Minister. So I want to make it crystal clear that on this occasion, I agree with her in relation to the Section 30 route being the best route for us and the gold standard.
Frankly, I have no wish to make any more front page headlines. I think there's a balance. I mean, both Joanna and I have made clear that we support the positioning of the First Minister for various very good strategic reasons. So I appreciate and I understand the sense of powerlessness we all feel. I don't know if you, like me, are a ranter. That means that I shout at the television. I sometimes shout at my husband, who completely agrees with me, but has to just take it anyway. And that is born of a sense of frustration. But it goes back to the very opening remarks Joanna made, the fact that my husband and I violently agree with each other in all of this matter doesn't matter a dime. Our emphasis and our focus must be on those reasonable people who, for a whole variety of reasons, voted no in 2014, that we convince them. So our convincer strategies, to use sort of sales talk, must be calm and measured and considered and polite and respectful all the time. And we cannot underestimate people's fear of change. That's entirely reasonable. So there is more work to be done, in my view, about getting the messaging out about what does it mean for people's pensions, that old currency debate. Yes, I know we're all tired of it, but people want to know the answers to these questions. So there is work that can be done. And I do appreciate the frustration, but also I do genuinely have confidence that even in the scenario you outlined, sir, where we've got that, we think, well, what do we do now? We can't underestimate how poor this looks round the rest of the world. People in Europe, round the rest of the world, are saying, my goodness, what on earth is going on there? And it's just keeping steady, keeping calm and measured and considered. And this is coming from a ranter.
Could I just ask one final question, because time's bearing on, ladies, but would one way to deal with this is for the Scottish Government to be a wee bit more imaginative in the use of existing powers under the devolution settlement, because they have the power to tax and they have the power to mitigate or vary basically virtually all reserve powers at Westminster. As I've already shown, you know, we have a far better, social society in this country through our education system, the support for education, the support for responses to the bedroom tax and all these kind of things. And I actually think that, you know, what we need to do is to drive the wedge between us and the rest of the UK in a wholly positive way, and that the Scottish Government and Parliament could do a bit more, be a bit more imaginative in these things, to use existing powers. So basically, it becomes irresistible that the UK Parliament agreed to a Section 30 agreement.
Setting aside the Section 30 agreement, which I think is Joanna's bag, in general terms, do I think that continued creativity around how you use your powers is a good thing? Absolutely, definitely. I think there's always more that the Scottish Government could be doing, and you know, I'd kind of put that on the level. However, from an economic perspective, I'm very sympathetic to the limitations that Derek Mackay has in his role, because the problem is fundamentally that we don't have the whole basket of economic powers. He may decide to change things. So, for example, something close to Graham's heart in terms of LBT or land and buildings transaction tax that replaced SLDT. We've got a very high rate if you're buying a house above a certain amount. And I know some people complain about that, but Derek has to try and manage the situation. Will he still get tax in that will cover the budget in Scotland, bearing in mind that we don't have the option to massively go have an overspend like they do in Westminster? So in principle, yes, I fully support the audacity of change and ambition of change, but at the same time, the actual legal situation is that the Scottish Government must balance its budget. So it's actually quite a hard challenge. I'll leave Section 30 to...
Well, I totally agree with Michelle on that last point. The Scottish Government has to balance its budget every year, and its block grant from Westminster has been progressively cut in real terms over the last decade. So any deficit that exists in relation to Scotland is run up by the UK government, not by the Scottish government, because the Scottish government has to balance its books. And I don't think it, I mean, a lot of money's been spent mitigating the bedroom tax, and I think that was the right thing to do. But the Scottish government cannot devote itself merely to creating new benefits and passing laws to mitigate the effect of Westminster's harsh pro-rich, you know, anti-low-income families and low-income people tax and spending policies. And that's why we need independence, because as Michelle said, you need the whole basket, you need to be able to control the whole economy, the whole basket of taxes, control over more than just income tax rates and scales in order to really change things fundamentally. So I think we have to be very wary of this argument that's trotted out by Scottish Labour that the Scottish Government can mitigate every bad law that's passed by Westminster, because of course Labour never cost that, because they know if they did, it would simply be unsustainable.
I suppose I should say that's me tilt. Anyway. I'll speak to these two ladies later. Anyway, first of all, just again to thank you all for turning up today. I hope you've enjoyed the experience and you've learned something, and that it will, those of you who are already persuaded about the merits of independence, go out and you know, be fishers not just of men but also women too. And finally, I would just like to thank Michelle and Joanna, give them a huge round of applause for them.
Indie Prime on Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime.